today I want to deal with individual approaches. Now, because of our emphasis in our society on individualism, for the most part in the past, these are the approaches that we have used, individualistic types of approaches. Sometimes we call them treatment, other times rehabilitation. But whatever, the method that we've pretty much dealt with, the method that we've pretty much employed, is the prison. And this has been a justification for imprisonment in the past. Reform of the criminal, reducing the likelihood of repeating the crime. Recidivism is a technical term. It has to do with the likelihood that a person will recommit a crime and be reincarcerated or reinstituted for the commitment of a crime. So recidivism rates have to do with the degree, the numbers, the rates of return or returns to prisons or to other types of institutions or treatment programs. Things like probation violation, parole violation, those types of things. There's been a lot of studies of recidivism to try to figure out who, what kind of persons, what kind of criminals, in other words, who's committed what kinds of crimes, are more likely to recidivate than others, what age groups, those kinds of things. We really haven't gotten into some of the characteristics of crime in recent years in the United States, but I've wanted to do that almost every session and never gotten to it. But let me say that in general, maybe some of you who read papers know this too, that crime rates in the United States have been on a steady decline for about the last 10 years. The rates of juvenile delinquency have also been on a steady decline for the last few years. Now there's this paradox that we find often because some parts of the criminal justice system, we call it a system, but they're not really, the various parts are not in tune with one another. So we find this, what's happening now is that prisons are jammed. We have all this call to build more prisons. At the same time, the crime rate is going down. When I I did my graduate work at Washington State University and then taught a couple places, and then when I moved back to California, they were closing prisons down, and this was the middle 70s, and there was a prison in Susanville that was going to be closed, but it was the main economic basis of the community, so the guards went on strike, and they finally kept it open, and you see the economic importance of prisons in this regard too. And so the people who are involved in prisons, whose work is in prisons, are of course most interested in keeping the beds full. And so there's never been any time in our history that we can't say that prisons aren't overcrowded. Once a prison is built, then it's quickly filled up, then it's over capacity, overrated capacity. What does the population in prison have to do with the crime rate? Nothing. There's not really any, over time, over the past 100 years, there doesn't seem to be any relationship. Well, recidivism studies then look at, well, what is the likelihood that people return to prison after they're let go? What is the effect of prison on people? After a century of these kinds of studies, we pretty well have discovered that you can predict that people will come back to prison if they started their crime career early and if they're property offenders. So juveniles, people who start their crime career as juveniles and are burglars or robbers, they are the most likely to recidivate. What people are really interested in these days, of course, are violence, violent crimes. And this has been very difficult to predict. Who is going to be violent? And if we could predict that, then we could incarcerate those people that are more dangerous and let those people out who are less dangerous. Now, the studies that are done on predicting violence have been pretty much of a failure. Because if we say it this way, if we have a group of people that are locked up and we're scared that they're going to go out and commit more crimes, then we can keep them locked up and we'll be 100% correct in our predictions, you know, in that those people won't recidivate, mainly because they never have been let out. But what would happen, you see, that policy is just would make prisons unmanageable, and the cost would be incredible. Prisons tend to be the most costly way of dealing with the crime problem. The cost of building one prison cell and maintaining it over time is a horrendous expenditure of funds. Last time I saw a figure, it was like between $30,000 and $40,000 to build one cell. And then you think of the depreciation over time and the upkeep and so on. And leads into a lot of money.
How much does it cost a year now to incarcerate one prisoner?
I'm not sure about that, but I think it's around $40,000 or something like that. You know, a lot of people joke about that. They say, well, why don't you take the guy and give him a Harvard education? It'd be cheaper. Mm-hmm. Well, that used to be true, but have you looked at how much it is somebody to hire for these things? I can give you sort of an indication of the kinds of studies that are done in this area. You have a group of people and that come out of prison, and then over time they're watched for like a year or 2 years, and then those people that recommit a violent crime that go back to prison, then the question is asked, could we have predicted that those people would commit those crimes, and on what basis? And how could we have protected ourselves against that? So first, the one kind of prediction might be, let's say they have two convictions for violent offenses. And for that reason, we keep them in longer. How many mistakes would we make in our prediction that way? In other words, if a person has two convictions for a violent crime, and so we keep all of those people in prison, what percentage of those would not commit another violent crime, in fact, you know, based on past evidence? Well, what these studies invariably show is that we end up locking up a lot more people than we need to in order to prevent a certain amount of crime. One study I was reading pointed out that with this kind of protective custody or incarceration as a way of preventing crimes, we would end up spending, this was a number of years ago and it was based on data in New York, spending $30,000 to prevent one robbery. And so you can see the prison costs a lot of money as a way of... Pardon?
You're talking about a violent robbery.
Right.
A victim, $30,000 does not sound to me to be money badly spent. Now that victim is going to have more than $30,000 of...
Okay, well, how many robberies do you think are committed in New York per year? And if we wanted to prevent those, we're talking about millions and millions of dollars, you know, if we're talking about the multiplying that.
No, I'm just saying your figure, $30,000 is a number. Does that bother you?
I think it would bother taxpayers.
But that also includes robberies of like $100.
It's not the money, it's the crime against person. It's the problem.
But there's such a vast number, right?
Yeah.
Times $30,000.
Yeah, I say it's not the money, it's the fact that you have a victim who can be seriously injured or whatever when you're talking about a robbery.
Yeah, that's right.
Your $30,000 is also covering... This person has probably committed more than one.
Right.
So that would help out.
Well, that might be the case. But the point I'm trying to get at is that we end up locking up maybe 90% of the people that we would lock up would be false predictions. In other words, people that wouldn't go out and commit further robberies. But those that we keep locked up because we're scared that they would. In other words, we can't make the distinction between those that would and those that wouldn't. So we end up locking up, if we use this as a strategy to prevent crime, we end up locking up a lot more people than are necessary. Because these predictive studies, as I was mentioning yesterday, it's impossible to predict the individual act that individuals commit. Yes, Mary?
Another thing I would would add is that there have been some studies done that show that a lot of the people that are locked up are not, are really inappropriately in prison. For instance, alcoholics, people with very, very serious emotional problems that aren't receiving the kind of care that they need. And if we're really concerned about crimes and safety, then it seems like to put money into those areas, a lot of juveniles, people that, who are really worsened by the prison experience, and that has a backlash for us as a society and a community, I think is another argument for looking at who's in prison and why.
Oftentimes prison officials are asked, like wardens or superintendents are asked, well, what percentage of the people here are really need to be locked up? And I've never seen a prediction less than 20, more than 25%. In other words, it's usually about 75 to 80% are not dangerous, you know, that there's really no reason that they need to be there. But you see, I'm talking now about prison as treatment or as prevention of crime, not talking about prison as punishment. Yeah. That's what I was talking about last week. Maybe you think that they all ought to be there just to be punished. And I think that's a common understanding of the use of prison these days, rather than as treatment or reform or prevention, those types of things.
Well, I understand that penitentiary is penitence.
Yeah, it's interesting that the group that was probably most influential in bringing about prisons in this country is now the group that is most vocal in trying to shut down prisons, and those are the Quakers. The Quakers originated the idea of the penitentiary, and their idea was that the person would be locked in a cell, totally isolated, and given a Bible, and then they would meditate and change their life that way. But that isolation led to a lot of unwanted consequences, a lot of sickness and death, and so on. And over, but the Quakers pioneered that idea. Central to the Quaker Church, of course, is that this personal meditation and quietude. But you see, those kinds of prisons are really expensive to totally isolate somebody for a long period of time. So the kind of penitentiary we have now is goes back to Rousseau's, some of Rousseau's architectural ideas as a way, you know, in people in cells and have them, you know, like this would be a good example. You have tiers of cells, and then they can all be watched because they're open, and you can have one person watching all of those people. Or Rousseau's idea was to have what he called a panopticon. In some prisons, I think in Chicago or in Illinois, Stateville prison,
Joliet.
Or Joliet is built in that round.
Well, they have one in their cell blocks. I went through it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In the center of it, they had a guard facility with a machine gun, so they can just rake the whole cell bank if they have to.
That'd be cheap.
But it was built in the 30s and was considered very innovative.
Yeah.
Right. The idea was real old, but it was one of the first ones to build on that particular idea. Some people have suggested using technology to keep track of people who are let out of prison, like brain implants or wristbands, you know, to keep track of people on parole. But again, this you think about this, and it's got this vision of the convict as sort of a passive individual, you know, like maybe an antelope or something that you put an ear band on or something and keep track of its migration patterns. But humans aren't like that. I mean, the moment you started doing something like that, there'd be a counter technology that developed to jam the system, you know. Some of you may have visited Alcatraz prison because they have these tours that go out there now. But that was the most secure prison in the United States, so all of the available technology that went into it. It's interesting, they had a silent system there, and there was no newspapers or magazines allowed, only letters from close first age relatives. In other words, the idea was to control as much as possible the prisoners there. And the moment they opened it, the prisoners started figuring out ways to get around the system. And people, you look at these kinds of oppressive conditions like prison, and they're kind of, in a way, they're kind of monuments to the human spirit, able to overcome the most oppressive kinds of conditions. To give you an indication, it's the impossibility of predicting this, this kind of recidivism. If I gave you each, this is based on probability, if I gave you each 7 coins, and I said, I want you to flip those coins until you get 7 heads in a row, and then I bet that any one of you in your next 7 tosses would get 7 heads. You can see the likelihood of my correct prediction is pretty, pretty shallow, pretty impossible. That's not a good bet. But if I bet that if you keep flipping those, everybody in this room will sooner or later get 7 heads in a row, that's a pretty safe bet. You see, so if we're to use that analogy, if we're predicting that any one person that will come out of prison will not recidivate, that's a pretty bad bet. It's not likely to succeed. But if I predict that everybody that comes out of prison sooner or later will not recidivate, that's a pretty good bet. But it's hard to predict the individual case. Very difficult, if not impossible. That's why I was saying yesterday that it ends up that if we lock people up because they're dangerous, or we lock people up because we think they're going to recidivate, then why do we let them out? What sense does it make to let them out? We have to do that for legal reasons. But you see, how it fails in terms of using, the idea fails when we think about using prisons in terms of treatment or reform. What we end up then is keeping people in for longer and longer periods because we're not sure, meaning that prisons that over time become unmanageable, the kinds of prisons that we have. They also become very expensive over time. As soon as we build another prison, it's going to be up to capacity and probably over capacity shortly after it's opened. And not only that, but the more people we lock up, the more failures we'll have, because the more recidivism there will be. It's just simple mathematics. If you lock up 100 people and we have, let's say, a 50% recidivism rate, you'll have 50 recidivists. If you lock up 1,000 people, you're going to have 500 recidivists. So it hurts recidivism rates to lock up more and more and more people. Treatment programs that are within institutions, like juvenile treatment programs and adult treatment programs, are quite variable in their effects. They're usually successful at first, and this is because the people that are chosen for the program know that they're special for some reason, and they're being treated specially. It's called, in social science, it's called the halo effect, or the Hawthorne effect. The idea came from industrial psychology experiments that were done back in the 20s and 30s to make assembly line workers more productive. They discovered that they took a group of people and put them in special conditions. No matter what those conditions were, their output improved. But it didn't work for the rest of the people when they extended the program to the entire factory. That's generally what happens with treatment programs. The first group that goes through knows they're being specially picked out, handled differently, and that they're expected to perform. And, and it kind of shows maybe the key to treatment, and that's to treat people as individuals, special cases, and to give them some concern and attention, and then they will respond. However, the program is successful at first, then it's extended other places, other situations, and pretty soon things are pretty much back to normal without a lot of differentness. The question then comes up, I wanted to ask you to pick up some Bibles over there. Could somebody grab a few and just pass them around? I wanted to emphasize on point number 3. Most of us have had the experience of choosing for ourselves some particular goal or goals. And we understand that we don't attain those goals by simply just sitting around and praying and expecting them to take place or come upon us. That somehow it requires some reordering of our lives or sacrifice. In other words, change, self-discipline, whatever. And so, getting back to the problem of crime, if we really want to deal with the problem of crime in our society, we can't just lay it on the shoulders of the criminals to solve that problem for us. In other words, the responsibility for reducing crime, if we desire that as a goal, and I don't even know if we do or not, because I don't know the extent to which people are willing to change or sacrifice parts of their lives, parts of the elements I was talking about yesterday as the American way of life, to achieve that end. But I wanted you to look at an example of this. If you turn to, this is like Old Testament week, if you turn to Judges, chapter 11. It talks about one of the judges of the Hebrews, Jephthah, who was a mighty warrior. And it goes into some of his battles here. And he was fighting against, I think the Ammonites. If you look at verse 29, in chapter 11, it says, "Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, and passed on to Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he passed on to the Ammonites. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, 'If thou wilt give the Ammonites into my hand,'" this is his goal, "'then whoever comes forth from the doors of my house to meet me when I return victorious from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's, and I will offer him up for a burnt offering.' So Jephthah crossed over to the Ammonites to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand. And he smote them from Aroer to the neighborhood of Minnith, 20 cities as far as blah blah blah. Then he gets to verse 34. "Then Jephthah came to his home at Mizpah, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with timbrels and with dances. She was his only child. Beside her he had neither son nor daughter. And when he saw her, he rent his clothes and said, 'Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you have become the cause of great trouble to me. For I have opened my mouth to the Lord, and I cannot take back my vow.' And she said to him, 'My father, if you have opened your mouth to the Lord, do to me according to what has gone forth from your mouth, now that the Lord has avenged you on your enemies and on the Ammonites.' And she said to her father," well, it goes on. It turns out then he sacrificed his daughter for this particular goal that he had, which, you know, we think of what kind of goal was that and what was the motivation for that goal. Well, if you think about that in our own lives, the kind of goals we choose for ourselves, mostly they're, I'm not talking about you personally in this room, but most of us think about goals and we're taught about goals in terms of things like personal wealth, success, achievement, and whatever. And we think about what we have to sacrifice to do that. Many times it might be our families, if we want to be successful. We have to maybe not pay so much attention to what happens to our children or what happens to our home life. So we withdraw attention from that to our own personal goals. And we may then become a famous person, but maybe not in our children's eyes. Or, you know, we may have sacrificed other areas in our lives. The point I'm trying to get at is that if we really desire something, then we really have to sacrifice. And so when we're talking about the crime problem, think, what are we willing to give up if we really wanted to deal with that? Now, it's not just, you don't find this idea, the idea of sacrifice and cleansing is something, and scapegoating is part of the same thing. The ritual of the scapegoat also goes back to the Hebrews. And this was a ritual cleansing of the community. And so if we say, we've got this crime problem, we want to deal with it, we want to cleanse ourselves of it, who are we going to sacrifice for that? Who do we persecute? And who do we lay that problem on? And those are the people that are that signify or symbolize the prison, the problem for us. And those are the people that we send to prison. And are these the best and the brightest of our society, those people that are in prison? There's another verse I was going to cite, but I forgot to write down the in Joshua, where Joshua fits the Battle of Jericho. And one of the things he tells the people is, look, don't plunder that town. It's been given into our hands, but it's been given into our hands because God wills us to have this land, not because we want to plunder and make ourselves rich. So what happens, of course, is you can't hold back the people, and they go in there and they steal stuff, and they, like the fruits of war. And so it turns out the Israelites lose the next few battles. And they can't, why are we losing these battles? And the word comes, well, because those people plundered Jericho. And so what does Joshua do? He takes the best and the brightest and sacrifices them as a sign to the people. Now, you can see what would happen if we sent our best and brightest to prison. We would reduce the crime problem pretty quickly. But as long as we send the dregs of our society to prison, it frees the rest of us to live our lives in terms of our own personal selfish goals. And that is not going to, I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that, I'm saying but that's not going to solve the problem, the kind of problem if we wanted to reduce crime in American society. Well, who is responsible for crime? And in a way, see, we say our ideology, our individualistic ideology is, look, you can pretty much do whatever you want to, but if you cause trouble, if you violate the law, we'll take away your responsibility. In other words, if you act irresponsible, we take away your responsibility. We send you to prison. Or if you can prove that you acted irresponsibly, then we don't do anything to you. And that's like insanity plea or diminished capacity, those kinds of things. That which was a big issue in the San Francisco Bay Area this year because the killer of the mayor and one of the city councilmen was released from jail after just doing a couple of years because he was able to show that it wasn't his fault. He was in fact acting responsibly according to the world as he saw it. But once we take away people's responsibility, who does have responsibility for their lives? Who takes the responsibility for those people that we've taken away the responsibility from? In other words, you see, if they commit crimes while in prison, while under somebody else's responsibility, then it's the responsibility of the prison officials. At least it should be. If we let those people out of prison, when do they get back their responsibility? When are they redeemed in our eyes? Now, in my work with prisoners, one of the saddest things that I'm always confronted with is that they have learned to act irresponsibly in prison. In other words, they're expected not to be responsible. And so they lose some understanding of control in their lives. They don't, and this is also true of mental hospital patients. They don't see themselves any longer as the controlling forces in their lives. I was talking to one guy who was being paroled. We had a program at our school where we would take parolees and give them a college education. And so I was visiting this prison where this guy was going to be paroled, and it was looked a lot like this. It was a forest camp up in the mountains in the Sierras. And we were standing there, there's no fences or anything, no problems in these kinds of prisons. You don't have riots and escapes and those kinds of things, because it's not a normal prison. I mean, if you think about this, if you were sent to a prison, probably the first thing you'd start thinking about is how to get around the rules, because there's so many rules. But if you don't have a lot of rules, then you don't have a lot of reasons for that rebellion. But the this guy said, looked around and he said, he was being released in a couple of weeks, and he says, well, I wonder how long till I'm back here again. And I thought, I didn't know what to think. You know, I thought, well, he's been taught that he doesn't have responsibility for his future, you know, or his existence. The being taught to be irresponsible is one of the effects, major effects of prison. If we assume that this responsibility is not just on the heads of people who are convicted of crime, but is the responsibility of the entire society, then what can we do about it? Well, I wanted to end up today by looking at some of the roots into and out of criminality. And if you have this, still have this passage in Judges, if you look back at chapter 10, I think Jephthah's my favorite guy in the Bible. Oh, excuse me, it's chapter 11. I wanted to mention three basic processes that are involved in becoming something else. And also that means that they're the same processes involved in coming out of criminality. The first of these is what a lot of criminologists have studied, and that's predispositions to criminality. That some people are in the position to take up a life of crime more so than others. And favorite explanations this way are in terms of things like poverty, broken homes. But this notion is the idea that humans can be reduced to objects and act just in terms of circumstances without reflecting on those circumstances or transcending those circumstances, which we know isn't true of humans. And you see, so those explanations based on things like broken homes and so on are lacking something. What they're lacking is the story of how the person got converted. You know, they may have been willing, they may have brought themselves to a point, or they may have been in a position to take up a life of crime, but what happened so that they were converted, so they became affiliated with the criminal way of life? An example of this is in chapter 11 of Judges. The first verse says, "Now Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty warrior, but he was the son of a harlot. Gilead was the father of Jephthah, and Gilead's wife also bore him sons. And when his wife's sons grew up, they thrust Jephthah out and said to him, 'You shall not inherit in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman.' Then Jephthah fled with his brothers and dwelt in the land of Tob. And worthless fellows collected around Jephthah, and he went raiding with them." You see what's left out, and you see how the circumstances that Jephthah found himself in pushed him into a life of crime. But what's left out there is there's a whole bunch left out in that one verse. You know, it's sort of a summary. It's like saying, well, so-and-so came from a family where there was a lot of disruption, and he or she was illegitimate, and so she became pregnant. You know, or so he became a criminal. But you don't hear the conversion or what's called the affiliation processes that are involved. I wanted to give you an example of one of the fellows that I worked with for a while. This guy was not in our program, but he was just a regular student. He came from a middle class family. He was black, and his parents were known in the community, and he had lots of brothers and sisters, teachers, and so on. And he came to college. He took a few classes from me, but he wasn't really a serious student. His name was Earl Smith, in case you ever run into him. He would, you know, come the first few classes, then he wouldn't come for like a month or so. And I could tell that he obviously had other interests that were involved in his life. So then one time he just disappeared, and I didn't see him for quite a while, and he dropped out of school. And it was about, that was in the fall semester, and then the next fall semester, he came into my office one day. And he said, I dropped out of school last year. And he says, you know what happened? I said, what? And he says, well, he said he got involved, which a lot of kids do, you know, in the excitement of the drug trade. And this is much more exciting than reading and studying books. You know, the idea of procuring and selling and the risk that's involved. It's an ideal male occupation to really feel big, you know, and the daring do kind of thing. machoism and all of that. So he said, well, he said, some guys came by one night to my apartment to buy some drugs, but it turned out to be a ripoff, and they shot me, and they shot me 8 times. And he said, so, he says, he says, I was unconscious, and they took me to the hospital, and he says, I woke up, and there was my family standing around me, and my mother was crying, and he said the doctor had said that he wasn't going to live, and he had all his lead inside of him. So he said, you know, he says, at that point I made a vow to God. And he says, I told God that if he let me live, I would give my life to him. So, you know, it shows this kind of change or conversion that takes place that you often hear about or read about in the Bible, like Paul is an example of that, where people are reduced to a level where they're forced to reevaluate their lives and the lives they've been living. And many of us don't get to that point where we're forced to look at everything from a new light or within a new light. A recent example of this is Charles Colson, who was one of Nixon's hatchet men, who ended up in a prison cell. Prisons are filled with people like this, who are at that point where they want to reevaluate their lives. The greatest recruiting ground for religious movements, political movements, or whatever, are those inmates in prison. You find them joining black guerrilla families, Nazis, whatever. They're ready for something different, some other means of or ways of bringing meaning into their lives. Well, Earl said that, he told me, he said, I'm going to go to a college in Texas, Bishop College. And he said, it's a place where you can get your bachelor's degree and also get a divinity degree at the same time. So he was going to be a minister. And he asked me if I would write him a letter of recommendation. And so I said, okay, so I did, I said I would. And he said, you know, he says, the other thing he says I had to do was I had to sort of redeem myself to people that I had ripped off in the last few years. He says, so what I've been doing is going around and telling the people that I broke into their apartments and stole things and stuff like that, that I'm the person who did it, and I'm telling them how much was it worth what I took, and I'm making have a repayment plan going with these people and so on. And I said, geez, that's, you know, I didn't really know what to think. And you know, the funny thing, then he left, and it couldn't have been a half hour later that this other student came in, and he was another kid who I knew was involved in drugs a lot, and you know, but not selling, and not as serious as Earl had been, but was just, you know, having a good old time in college. And he said, you know, he says, the craziest thing just happened to me. He says, a couple years ago, somebody broke into my apartment and stole my stereo. And he says, you know, they never find out who it was. He says, you know, and this guy just came up to me in the hallway, and he said that he was the guy that broke into my apartment and stole my stereo, and then he wanted to pay me back. And this guy, he just couldn't get over that. You know, just that, well, I saw Earl a couple times. He came back in that area to see friends, and I just said hello to him. And I hadn't seen him probably for about 3 or 4 years. Then last fall, I took a group of students on my annual tour to San Quentin. And we were waiting at the main gate to go in. And I looked at this guy standing next to me, and he was in a suit and tie, and I said, you know, that guy really looks familiar. And I recognized him. It was this Earl Smith. I said, hey, Earl, how you doing? He says, okay. And I said, what are you doing here anyway? He says, I'm the chaplain here now. So we went into the prison, and there on the, when you come right into the prison in San Quentin, there's a chapel on the right. And there on the chapel billboard, it says, Reverend Earl Smith preaching next Sunday. Yeah, it's just an amazing story, you know, but it brings into human terms this process of affiliation and disaffiliation with criminal ways of life and with straight ways of life. The Earl was this person who avoided, and so many people who are arrested for crimes can do this. Most of us in this room, if you were arrested, you wouldn't consider yourself a criminal. In other words, you'd say, well, it had to do with circumstances. Oh, I forgot to pay that parking ticket. I knew I forgot something, but I'm really not a criminal. You know, or if somebody accuses you of wrongdoing, And you may have done the thing, but not because you have the motivations of being a criminal. You know, you'll avoid that because you identify yourself with the middle class community. And this is the way Earl was too. The most difficult convicts to deal with are those that have actually become the symbol of crime and accept that definition of themselves. So when you need a criminal, they'll provide the role for you. They go throughout their lives playing like the professional criminal. And we need these people in our society. You know, we need this role to point to our, you know, our kids. You, if you go by a prison, you say, see what's going to happen to you? And you need to point at these people and say, you know, those are bad people and those kinds of things. There are people that are converted and take that self-concept into themselves. And they're the most difficult people. One case we had, and I wanted to use this as sort of a bridge to Friday's session, because some of you may be interested in this area, or you may find yourself working with people who have been involved in criminal ways of life, and I wanted to deal somewhat with the way those people look at the world. But this guy, he was raised in a family in a rural area of California outside of Oroville, which is an old mining, lumbering area. And he lived outside of town, and his family was a welfare family. And before he was born, his family was stigmatized by the community. And some of the problems, they were involved in crime. They also worked the welfare system. They saw themselves, they justified doing that because of the position that they held in the community. And so a lot of, you know, hardworking people, law enforcement officials and so on, detested them for a variety of reasons. But one of them was because these people never worked and they seemed to be able to survive better than a lot of people in the community. But Dell, this guy's name was Dell, and he had a couple older brothers who were heavily involved in crime. The mother had been married 3 times. There were 10 kids in the family. 5 were white and 5 were black, and because of various husbands and stepchildren and so on. Dell himself was white, and his older brothers were heavily involved in crime. What they would like to do is on a Saturday night get drunk and go and break into people's houses and steal things. And occasionally it would happen they'd get caught, so they'd have to kill the people. And one of the, when Dell was first arrested, he was 8 years old. And his part in the crimes were he was small, so his brothers would boost him up through windows, and then he would go around and let them in. His 2 older brothers were on death row at San Quentin, and then their case was overturned because the stupid judge had failed to grant a change of venue, and the case that they were involved in so upset the community that they were almost lynched. And they had, during the trial, people would get up and in the courtroom and say, you know, crucify, you know, or say, hang him, you know, or something like that. And this was in the minutes, and they obviously couldn't get a fair trial in those circumstances. So later on, the case was overturned on appeal. One of the brothers then ended up back on death row after standing trial and being convicted of some more murders. The one brother that was loose, Dell brought him by my house one night, and this guy knocked on the door, and you know, he looked to me like he looked like a beast, and I answered the door, and he says, "Hi, my name is Bob. I've been accused of killing 20 people, stood trial for 10. And I thought, oh my God. Well, Dell was a smart kid, and he started his progress up through the system at 8 years old, foster homes, then the California Youth Authority facilities, county facilities, and then ending up in prison, the lightweight prisons. Then he was still going on. He had gotten his degree in high school degree along the way someplace, and being open to these opportunities to use the system, he saw this program where he could go to college. He thought, wow, that would really be groovy. So he applied and was accepted. Well, he took a class from me, and I hadn't met him before, but he would sit in the back of the class, and he wore dark glasses, and he wore one of these little punk hats, and he had a little goatee, and he'd sit there rocking back in his chair like this, and then I'd be up there lecturing. And about every 5 minutes, I'd look up and see out of the corner of my eye, he'd be going like this. I'd say, yes? And he'd say, no. No. All wrong. You know, and he's driving me nuts. And so I thought, what am I going to do about this guy? So I said, why don't you come in and talk to me after class? I want to, you know, find out, you know, where you're coming from and so on. So he started coming in, and I started having talks with him and find out something about his background and the source of his anti-authoritarian attitudes. And then one night, I was sitting in my living room, and there was a knock at the door, and he was there. And he came in, and he just needed, you know, it turned out he just needed somebody to talk to. He needed a friend. And his girlfriend, he didn't tell us, but his girlfriend was out in the car, you know, for about 2 or 3 hours. And what finally happened after a while was I got him to see how he was playing this role of the crook for the criminal justice system in service to society, and how he was being exploited on that basis, and how he was not taking control of his own life, but simply living his life as the criminal justice system expected him to live it. And once you see a person is signified or symbolized this way, they become useful for example, professional suspects. Well, and they're not really paid for it. You know, the kind of life they lead is, you know, constantly being the knock on the door, being brought down to the police station, questioned about some crime has taken place in the community. After a while, they get tired of this harassment, they move to another community, of course, but then word gets passed from police department, they become suspects in that community. And pretty soon, slowly, he was a smart kid, he realized how he, these roles that he was playing, and how he could attempt to avoid that to some extent. Although, to his involvement, and you see the various allegiances that he had, like to his family, to other ex-convicts that were his friends, and so on, how difficult it is to balance those interests and to take control of one's life. In therapy, in psychotherapy, you know, lots of times patients get into psychotherapy and they ask the psychiatrist, when am I going to be able to leave? You know, when am I cured? You know, or something like that. And probably the best answer is when you're able to be a therapist for somebody else. In other words, when you've come to accept yourself so much that you can open yourself up to other people. Well, Dale had this problem going in and out of prison because he had beefs hanging over his head from past years that he had, you know, he had a regular lawyer, his family had a regular lawyer, and because of motions in court and extenuations and so on, he would stay out of jail. Eventually he decided that he was just going to take it all, you know, take all the beefs, consolidate them, do time, and then he would be done with it. And so he did. And so I visited him in prison about once a week. He was changed around from prison to prison. And slowly he started becoming a therapist for other prisoners and started seeing, you know, and communicating with them about their lives and where he was. He got the nickname of, they called him the preacher. And his proudest, his only possession was a Bible. And he had saved up his money, you know, one of these things, you know, the advertisements had come along, you know, get your Bible with your name embossed on it in gold. So he had this Bible with his name on it, and it said Preacher Dale on it. And so that was his nickname. But then after he got out of prison, he realized that he couldn't stay within the community because he had too many debts, I suppose you'd put it, or too many people after him that he had wronged previously, and so including law enforcement officials. He knew how to play that system pretty well too, and so the last time I heard from him, he had moved to Missouri or Arkansas, someplace like that, and I haven't heard from him in about 2 or 3 years. But what I'm trying to show you is the difficulty of getting people to change once they've accepted this this role of the crook or of the thief in society. And you ask yourself, most of all of us have stolen something. When we were children, maybe we were still doing it, I don't know. But most of us avoid the label of considering ourselves to be a thief. You know, we excuse it one way or another, we justify it one way or another, or even if we're caught, we look at it as, yep, that's what my mom told me. You know, you steal, you're going to get punished. But we don't say to ourselves, I steal because I'm a thief. We don't have that identity confirmed upon us. Some people do. And once that happens, it's like being under a spell. You know, it's like the prince that's turned into a frog and needs to get kissed before he can turn back into a prince again. And this has to do with redeeming these criminals. You know, if we look at, you look at a student who is an ex-convict, you don't say, there's a student reading a book. You say, there's an ex-convict playing like a student reading a book. I remember when I was at Pacific Lutheran University, the athletics teams there would go play some of the teams at the local prison at McNeil Island. And the guys that were going out there to play had this vision, you know, that they were going to get their throat cut, you know, or, you know, how can convicts play basketball, you know, this something strange, you know. So it's the idea that there's somebody, somebody you'd see like out there, you'd say there's somebody playing baseball. But with this identity of the convict, we think there's an ex-convict playing baseball. And the notion is that they're not going to follow the rules unless they're watched. See, the rest of us that don't have that identity, people expect us to follow the rules. That's why it's so easy for us to commit crimes. People expect us to follow the rules. And we're following the rules just because we want to. But for convicts, they're following the rules because somebody's watching them. They can't be trusted. And when is that lift? When did they get out from under that spell? When is that spell lifted off their head? When does somebody kiss them and turn them back into a prince again? There's no answer to that question. What we expect is that the person becomes, we require that the person becomes a star witness against themselves, him or herself, and take on the identity and accept it and say, yes, I am a crook. Yes, I am a thief. Cop out, admit it, and then become a professional ex-convict or something like that. And eventually, over the years, it may not make any difference any longer. They may be accepted back into society on terms of normality. But to protest it, and you know, if you go into prison, you see a lot of innocent people who excuse or justify why they're there, and it's not their fault. We're not ready to excuse those people. We have to have them admit to their identity. And it's a two-edged sword then. It's the way that it's the route to normality, but also it's accepting an idea of oneself that's really pejorative and negative and can backfire. Well, I've talked long enough. Do you have any comments? Or maybe some of you have experiences too.
I was reading something about the Japanese prison system. Do you know anything about them?
It's based on the Japanese social structure. They're up at 4 in the morning, you know, running around. They work hard. It's based on hard work. Prisons, you know, the style of prison life, generally reflects what's going on in society outside. The first prisons were workhouses and industrial occupations. Assembly line, weaving, textile, woodworking, those types of things on an assembly line basis. Well, what's happened to that kind of work in our society? Not a lot of, it's hard, you know, those are the kinds of jobs that are disappearing. So that's true in prison too. In California passed a rule that all prisoners had to work except for those high percentage of prisoners that are locked up 24 hours a day and can't work. But prison jobs generally take about 5 minutes, and then you have the rest of the day. That's an exaggeration. But you know, it's like sweep the hallway, or report here for an hour or two and do this or that, the garbology detail or something. South American or Central American prisons, and Mexican prisons too, recognize the importance of the family and the father's position in the family. So family contacts are in I heard somebody who had visited Venezuelan prisons, and she said that that what they try to do is have a family enterprise of some sort, so that the wife and children come out to the prison in the morning, and then they make or weave or make pottery or something like this as a way of supporting the father while he's in prison and keeping the family out of a welfare system that doesn't exist there. There's a lot of new ideas along these lines. Last week I asked Mary to talk about the thing that she had been involved in. Some of you were here. Did you get to hear her? Why don't you say just a couple words about that?
I honestly thought of it a couple times while we were talking today. I appreciated a lot what you said today about the whole role of criminal and crook that becomes a part of the mentality of people who are involved in the criminal justice system. And even compiled with that would be someone who's a drug user who has a whole mentality of manipulation and lying about narcotics usage. I think that's a part of it. And I worked with a guy who was probably one of the more compassionate people I've known, who taught me a lot about the streets of D.C., who went in his Thunderbird on Saturday out to the jail, interviewed people, learned a lot from Mike. And also saw him struggle sometimes day to day between the pull of breaking from his past on the streets and serving time for armed robberies and being an excellent drug counselor, and the pull between kind of he had money, you know, he knew he could do it, and yet the pull to the other, kind of the other world, and that real inner tension in him. I think it's a very real thing. I worked with what's called the third party custody program that is a very viable alternative to jails in the DC area, where when someone's arrested at the time of arraignment, the judge will consider putting them in our custody rather than sticking them in jail during the time that they're awaiting trial. And it was a really good program because a lot of the people that were coming through the system did need to be in jail, couldn't afford bond if they had it set on them, and were put into at least a positive situation, you know, before they even went to trial. I worked with people who had been arrested for anything from shoplifting to homicide, murder one. The violent offenses were obviously much harder to make decisions on. Probably two of the better clients I had were convicted of, were arrested for murder. One was acquitted, one led to a lesser offense. I saw a change in them. We had really successful, like a less than 1% recidivism rate for people who were arrested for violent offenses in our custody. They were required to report to us 3 times a week, and we just had really good results with that. Keeping them out, at least, I'm talking about the time during which they were waiting trial, I don't know, after they were done in the court system. You can't guarantee or project that.
As a teacher, I was impressed with your stressing to each of the students constantly about being responsible. You know, that was taken on a new importance to me after the
change. You know, it's surprising, even those, but I'll go ahead.
A couple things. I think we lived at the penitentiary department, and had a lot of contact, and had some good friends who were out. I think they're both back in now. But I remember one night we sat up late talking, and she said, I've never had a straight friend like you. And they don't have access to us. And the other thing was that she had tried so many different religions. She knew her religion. She had tried everything. And we sat talking and talking, and, you know, boiled down, you know, I don't have any answers. And she was shocked by that. And she had she'd turned down all the other religions that she'd really tried practicing in her own. But both these two, I personally don't think ever had a chance.
I'd like to, that's what I wanted to deal with on Friday.
I won't be here.
Oh.
But that's why we've gotten into foster care, because, and our oldest one is 28 now, and she comes home, she'll call us every 2 years or so to dry out or whatever, and she doesn't have access. She doesn't, but she'd been in 10 foster homes by the time she was 15, and alcohol parents, but she hasn't been in treatment. I mean, she hasn't been incarcerated for anything, but just the whole group, the peer group.
It isn't just crooks, you know, or people who are on the wrong side of the law who have found that they're not in control of their lives. There's so many middle-class people who end up at 35, 40 years old with midlife crises because they discover they've done everything in their life just because other people wanted them to do that. And so they flip out and change their entire life, or else lead a life of some kind of despair. And so I think, you know, we can recognize it or understand it in those terms, too. It's taking control of your own existence. And once you do that, and then it's possible to start opening up to other people. But one first has to understand this self-love and this ability to control and accept oneself, discipline and sacrifice.